The Peter Schiff Show.
Today's podcast is sponsored by NetSuite, the easy-to-use cloud-based business management software for every aspect of your business. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible finance program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/gold. Today's podcast is also sponsored by Neolite, the makers of some of the most effective and best-valued red light therapy products currently on the market to promote healthy living and longevity. Check out the exclusive discounts for my audience at neolitebed.com.
Good evening, everybody. It's been a while since I did one of these Sunday night podcasts. And, you know, I couldn't do one tomorrow night. It is the first night of Passover. And I'll be at a Seder, and certainly happy Passover to my Jewish audience. You know, normally Passover doesn't happen this late relative to Easter. The two holidays tend to happen closer together. But this year, Passover is quite a bit later than Easter. So we're doing a Sunday night podcast. I got so tied up on Friday. I was going to do one Friday because I kind of was interested in talking about the events of the day, but I recorded two very long interviews on other people's podcasts on Friday. So I really didn't, I think I had stamina to do a podcast. So I held off to this evening. I want to start off by talking about a significant development. At least I think it potentially could be significant. We'll see. But in the stock market, when it comes to the momentum type stocks, I've talked about the Magnificent Seven stocks, the stocks that have gone up the most, that have been dominating the gains and really obscuring the losses that a lot of stocks have had, and masking them, because these stocks that have gone up so much represent such a large percentage of a market cap weighted S&P 500 index. Well, this week, a lot of these stocks got taken out to the woodshed and beaten up. In fact, Friday was the most significant divergence. You had the NASDAQ down over 2% on Friday. But what's significant about the 2% drop in the NASDAQ is that the Dow was up better than 200 points. So you actually had people buying Dow stocks and dumping the NASDAQ, and the Mag 7 got hit hardest. Some of the stocks were down on the week 5 or 6%, which was kind of in line with the drop. The NASDAQ was down 5.5%, I think, on the week, but you know, 2% or 40% of the drop on Friday alone. It was one of the biggest weekly declines in the NASDAQ now in about 2 years. So significant. But looking at the leaders on the downside, two of the Magnificent Seven stocks, Tesla and Nvidia, were down 14% on the week. And Netflix was down 11%. I think most of that gain on Friday following their earnings. In fact, I think they actually had better earnings than the market had expected, but maybe the guidance was what they were looking for, but they still clobbered the stock. So to me, this is the beginning of a long overdue decline in these stocks. In fact, they've been defying a gravity for many, many months as the markets have been pricing out out of the rate cuts that they priced in. Now, I was talking about this a long time ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, when the talk of rate cuts was hot and heavy, when they were talking about 4 rate cuts, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever it was. Everybody was talking about all these cuts that were going to happen. And I kept saying, we're not going to get all these cuts, that inflation is not going to allow the Fed to cut rates all these, you know, so many times. And the reason that Wall Street assumed that the Fed was going to be able to slip in all these cuts was because everybody thought that inflation was going to come down. But to me, that seemed like a ridiculous assumption to make. And the evidence that was building clearly showed that inflation was in the process of bottoming, at least the way they measure it with the CPI or the PCE. And if you looked at what was happening with commodity prices, it made sense that inflation was going to head back higher. And of course, if you understand inflation, and I kept pointing it out on this podcast, that what was significant was the increase in credit that was driving the consumption, both government credit and household credit. Everybody was borrowing more and more and more so they can keep on spending. And so my point was that the rate hikes had been inadequate for the job. They hadn't bent that demand curve. The higher rates weren't constraining borrowing. Consumers and governments just kept borrowing anyway and kept on spending. So all that demand was there. Meanwhile, I kept pointing to the manufacturing recession. The output wasn't there. So we're not producing more, but we're borrowing to spend more. It was clear that prices were headed up. And in fact, we flooded the economy with inflation for over a decade. And that inflation finally reared its head. This was the beginning, not the end. I mean, people are still claiming. I look at, you know, Paul Krugman is doing another victory lap, trying to claim that the inflation that he never saw coming is over. They're saying, you know, oh, it's just a one-time jump in inflation, and now we're right back down. So no harm, no foul, which, first of all, ignores the fact that that one-time jump was significant. It was like a 30% increase in the cost of living. That means something. Even if inflation did come back down to 2% and stayed there, that one-time jump is huge. For Paul Krugman and all of those other economists to dismiss that as if it is nothing, that's the reason so many Americans are now moonlighting. They've got second or third jobs because of that one-time jump in inflation has destroyed the purchasing power of their incomes. And so now they have to work more to buy what they used to be able to buy working less. But it's not even one time. The only thing that's one time is the decline. The decline from 9% to 3%, that was the one time. Right? That's over. And now we're heading back up. Look, I went to the store today. I went to Walgreens. I needed to buy batteries. We were out of the 9-volt batteries. So I went down and I bought two batteries, and it was like $14, $14.50 for the 11% sales tax. So I paid like $8 for a battery. I mean, one battery. You know, there is some, apparently, some influencer on Instagram went to Whole Foods, and she was very upset that she paid $7 for an apple, one apple, which, you know, I don't know. I mean, that seems like a ridiculous price to me to pay for an apple. I mean, an apple, I remember I used to buy apples. They were like 25 cents, 50 cents, you know, $7 for a single apple. You know, if you think about it, that's about the minimum wage. Minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. One apple? Someone's going to work for an hour? Here you go. Here's your apple. In fact, you don't even get the whole apple. The government takes a bite out of it because you got to pay payroll taxes. So after taxes, you might have to an hour and 15 minutes to have one apple. I mean, that really shows you the degree to which inflation is eviscerating people's incomes and their living standards. And again, it's not inflation, it's the government. When people talk about inflation, we have an inflation problem, we have a government problem. The problem is government is too big. It spends too much money and it has to create inflation because it doesn't have the guts to raise our taxes. You know, for example, this passed, Congress did. I guess Biden hasn't put his John Hancock on the bill yet. I'm sure he will. But the House just passed this $95 billion foreign aid bill. Where's the money coming from to cover the cost of the foreign aid? Nobody's appropriating any money to pay for this. We just voted for bigger deficits, right? The national debt, right, just goes up by almost $100 billion overnight on top of the other gains, because we're going to give another $61 billion to the Ukraine on top of the, what, $75 billion we've already given them. What's that, $135 billion to $140 billion? That's serious money that we sent to the Ukraine. What did that money buy us? The deaths of thousands, tens of thousands of Ukrainians and Russians. I mean, the war is no closer to being won now than it was a couple of years ago. In fact, it's just closer to being lost. All we're doing is postponing the inevitable and driving up the fatality rates on both sides. This is real money. Where's it coming from? More inflation. You know, that's the national security threat. I mean, supposedly we got to give money to the Ukraine because that keeps America safe. Because if we don't stop Putin at the Ukraine, well, the rest of Europe is there. And the next thing we know, it's World War III, right? So we can't appease Putin like they appeased Hitler, right? So we got to keep spending this money. The real threat to our national security is coming from Washington, D.C. It's the deficits that we're running up. It's the money that we're printing. That is the threat, not what's going on in the Ukraine. That is a problem for the Ukrainians. You know, it's a problem for Russians who are dying, but it's not a problem for Americans. The problem for Americans is that we're paying for it all. And of course, you know, we've got this blood on our hands, if you want to ignore that, but we're paying for this. Look, assuming that politicians really thought this aid was necessary. You know, and there's some Israeli aid in there. And I don't know, we gave money to other countries, although we're not even giving our own money because we don't have it. I mean, we're having to borrow money to give it away. Right? I mean, which makes no sense. Sure, if we were swimming in surpluses and we wanted to share some of our surpluses, but we're already broke, right? We have no business giving aid to anybody when we need the aid ourselves. But if these politicians really believed that this was worth it, right? That we really need to give this money to the Ukraine, then pay for it. If it's worth doing, it's worth paying for. If we really need to do this, level with the American public and say, you know, we got to send $61 billion to the Ukraine, so we got to raise your taxes to pay for it. Be honest. And if you're not willing to tell Americans they have to pay for the aid, then don't vote for it. The other way to pay for it is cut spending somewhere. Just make it, you know, revenue neutral. So at least it's not extra, right? Cut something else. But no, the politicians that are voting for this aid don't think it's worth cutting any other government programs to pay for it. And it's not worth raising anybody's taxes to pay for it. Well, if it's not worth higher taxes and it's not worth cutting spending, then it's not worth doing. Don't do it. No, they think they can have everything, right? It all, you know, money from heaven, right? It just grows on trees. Doesn't matter. We can do everything. So it should have been obvious. And I just digressed into this whole topic, but it should have been obvious 6 months ago, a year ago, that we weren't going to get these rate cuts because inflation wasn't going to cooperate. Inflation wasn't going to come down the way everybody believed. But it was that forward look at an easing of monetary policy, that's what was powering the Magnificent Seven or Magnificent Five or Six, because a couple of them, Tesla started going down a while ago, while the other ones were still making new highs, you know, riding the AI gravy train. But all the while that these rate cuts were being backed out and bond yields were rising, more rates were rising, you know, back above now 7 again. I forget what the 30-year rate is, but it's headed up there. But the stock market was really ignoring it. The NASDAQ was ignoring it because those are the stocks that are the most sensitive to interest rates. I've discussed it on the podcast before. The companies that are promising big numbers in the future, growth stocks, those future earnings are much more valuable today when interest rates are low. So when they're not low, when they're higher, those stocks should take a much bigger hit than, you know, traditional value-oriented dividend-paying stocks that are paying right now, that have the earnings right now, and that are paying their shareholders. So for a while, these stocks kept going up, and I was like, you know, this doesn't make sense. They've got to go down. They've got to break. Well, this week, or last week rather, was the week they broke. because you had this big divergence. The NASDAQ, as I said, was down about 5.5%. The Dow was actually positive on the week. I mean, just like a point or so. It was barely positive. But what's significant is that it wasn't negative, and the NASDAQ held. So I don't think this is the end of a rotation. My bet is it's the beginning of a rotation. There's going to be a lot more momentum to this trade as people sell growth and buy value. Now, that doesn't mean that the Dow is going to keep on rising in the face of a falling NASDAQ. I think the Dow, you know, is going to turn down. It's just not going to fall as much as the NASDAQ. I think we have a bigger correction coming. I think until we get some real weak economic data, which I also think is coming, because even right now, some people are talking about the potential for rate hikes, which I've been talking about again for months and months and months. All of a sudden, they're saying that it could happen. Anyway, I got more on that, a lot more discussed. So we got a commercial, so stick around. I'll be right back.
Here's some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your products or services, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you'll reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware requirement, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible finance program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/gold.
All right, so I'm talking about the divergence that we had last week as investors rotated out of momentum, out of the Magnificent Seven, into value-oriented stocks. Energy stocks got a nice bid. Precious metal stocks got bid. And gold too closed the week at its highest ever weekly close and its second highest close ever. I think we closed around 2,392, 94, something like that. So that was the highest weekly close in the history of gold. It was the second highest daily close. And intraday on Thursday night, early Friday morning, gold hit a new all-time record high. It spiked up to 2,416. And the catalyst for that $35 jump, which it didn't hold, was the Israeli retaliation against Iran. And so bombs were going off. People didn't really know initially to what extent the hostilities were escalating, what was behind it. And so in a knee-jerk reaction, there was a flight to safe havens. And, you know, the dollar, which I don't regard as a safe haven, but which a lot of people do, dollar rose, although it wasn't that big a gain in the dollar. So I think if that's all the dollar could muster, maybe that's a good sign that the dollar is topping out here with the dollar index just above 106. But gold immediately spiked as the S&P futures got clobbered. The Dow futures were down over 500 points on the lows. S&P was down about 1.5%. And gold was up 1.5%. So gold acted exactly as you would expect. It was a safe haven in times of uncertainty. But what happened to Bitcoin? This is a significance event. Everybody is making excuses. Bitcoin crashed 6%. So while gold was going up 1.5%, Bitcoin was going down 6%. Now, how is that a safe haven? If the Bitcoin promoters are going to claim that Bitcoin is a digital gold, meaning it's some kind of digital substitute or alternative to gold, then it's got to have gold's properties. Now, it doesn't have any of gold's physical properties. That's the key, right? It's not a metal. You can't make anything out of Bitcoin. You know, hey, I got a gold bracelet on, you know, from Monet. I've been wearing this. It's a new bracelet that I got. It's got 4 ounces of gold in it. But, you know, you can't have a Bitcoin bracelet. Now, some people might think, well, who cares about a bracelet? Well, people like jewelry. People wear jewelry. But of course, it's also used in electronics and all sorts of things. It's not just used for jewelry. And of course, you can't do anything, right? There's no use for Bitcoin. But if you're going to say, well, we can put it in a portfolio and it's going to behave like gold, right? So even if you can't use it in industry, even if you can't use it in jewelry, you can still put it in your portfolio. And for some magical reason, even though it has none of the properties of gold, it's going to behave as if it were gold, right? Only better. Well, gold went up 1.5% as a safe haven, and Bitcoin went down by 6%. So how is that a safe haven? I mean, how could you hedge anything? I mean, if you had a stock portfolio and you wanted to hedge it, if you bought gold, okay, that would have acted as a hedge. Stocks were down 1.5% and your gold went up 1.5%. So it kind of hedged out the risk, some of the volatility. But if you had a stock portfolio and then you hedged it with Bitcoin, you made your portfolio even riskier. So what good is that? My stocks went down 1.5% and then my hedge went down by 6%. That's not a hedge. So if Bitcoin is not a safe haven like gold, then how is it digital gold? It's not. Now, of course, they're excusing this. They did the same thing when the initial attack, when Iran, right, attacked Israel and sent all those missiles over there and whatever they were, the drones. It was a Saturday. None of the markets were open and Bitcoin got clobbered. And all the Bitcoin pumpers on television explaining why this happened. And they said, well, you know, all the other markets were closed. Bitcoin was the only market that there was. And so everybody sold Bitcoin because there was nothing else they could sell, right? That was their explanation. Of course, they overlooked the fact that people were supposed to be buying Bitcoin according to, you know, what they touted as. But that was their excuse. Well, Bitcoin was the only market that was open. Well, on Thursday night, all the markets were open. So you had plenty of things to sell. But everybody sold Bitcoin just as hard. I mean, it went down below 60,000, which, of course, is still a high price. But remember, we got up to almost 74,000. And so that's almost 20%, you know, the drop from its peak. Of course, in terms of gold, it's more than that. But in terms of dollars, that's what it was. But that's a big move. Now, the Bitcoiners make a big deal out of the fact that, you know, it bounced back. Well, everything bounced back. I mean, the Dow ended up positive 200. Well, the NASDAQ didn't really bounce back, but the Dow bounced back. The foreign currencies back, you know, bounced back. So the dollar surrendered its gains. So everything kind of unwound. Gold came back down. It still closed positive. It had a nice day, but it sold off of its highs because people took another look at Israel's response and decided that it was limited. It wasn't that big a deal. I mean, I still think it means that we've dialed it up a notch and the tensions and the geopolitical risks and uncertainties, you know, have heightened. But the markets then, you know, breathed a collective sigh of relief. Hey, it really wasn't as bad as it could have been. And they reversed all this stuff. So Bitcoin, let me look at where it is right now. It's just around 65,000. So it's recovered over 5,000 from its lows. But what's significant is not that Bitcoin went up when other risk assets went up. What's significant is that it went down when other risk assets went down. It didn't behave anything like gold. So it's not really digital gold. I mean, maybe it's a digital tech stock, except without any earnings or without any revenues. You know, it's got more in common with your typical tech company that loses money than it does with gold, right? The comparison to gold is a complete fraud. Oh, and by the way, there was another so-called significant event happened on Friday night. another reason why I kind of wanted to do the podcast, but it was, you know, I had too much going on. It was Friday night that the Bitcoiners rung in the halvening, like it was like New Year's Eve, which only happens once every 4 years. So it's an even bigger celebration for the Bitcoin crowd. But I mean, this was like, you know, Christmas and New Year's Eve and Halloween and all these holidays all rolled into one. It was like a big collective celebration, as if there was actually something significant to celebrate. There was nothing significant other than the fact that the miners are now going to get a smaller reward for processing Bitcoin transactions. That might be why. I just checked. It now costs $128 to send any Satoshi, any fraction of a Bitcoin. So if I wanted to send somebody $5 worth of Bitcoin, it cost me $128 to do it, and it would take a half hour to process. That's another reason that Bitcoin can't be a cryptocurrency, a digital currency, because you can't use a currency if it costs me $128 every time I want to buy it, because most transactions are less than $128. So it's going to cost me more to pay somebody than the value of what I'm buying. So it's never going to be used. Now, I know all these Bitcoiners say, well, so what? It doesn't have to be used as a currency. It's digital gold. Well, then what properties does it have? If it failed the very thing it was designed to be, a currency, because it's failed as a currency, that means it succeeds at being gold? No, it's not gold at all. They had to come up with that to explain why it wouldn't work as a currency. Now, some people say, well, you know, how much does it cost to send somebody gold? That's not the point. People aren't using gold as a currency. But you know what? If you wanted to tokenize gold and put it on a blockchain, it would work. If people wanted to use gold as a currency, it would be fast and cheap. You could do it on the blockchain. They just don't want to do it right now. Now, maybe they will in the near future. But even if people wanted to use Bitcoin as a currency, it can't be used that way because it's too expensive and it's too slow. And just because it fails as a currency doesn't mean it succeeds as gold, because it's an even bigger failure at being gold than it was as a currency, because it's not a store of value, because it has no value to store, and it's not a safe haven. It's proved that twice in the last week. Every time people are worried, they sell their Bitcoin even faster than they sell their stock. And what are they buying? They're buying an actual safe haven. They're buying gold. That's why gold is going up and Bitcoin is going down. Anyway, I got another quick commercial, so stick around. I'm going to wrap up this podcast at the other side of the break.
Now that I'm 60 years old, health and longevity are one of my primary concerns. I've done a lot of research into the subject, and I've even created my own wellness and longevity center in my own house. Part of my daily routine includes red light therapy, which improves health and promotes longevity by regulating stem cell activity, reducing inflammation, and boosting immune system functions. Red light therapy has also been shown to improve skin health by reducing the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles and improving skin texture. Light therapy, in particular, red and infrared, have been shown to reduce joint pain and inflammation, improve your range of motion, and speed up muscle recovery. Red light therapy is believed to help alleviate symptoms of depression and anxiety by increasing your levels of serotonin, a neurotransmitter responsible for regulating mood. Red light therapy minimizes oxidative stress by rebalancing the levels of free radicals and antioxidants in your body. It also boosts the generation of ATP, the cellular energy source within the mitochondria. This enhances your energy metabolism, leading to improved cellular repair, tissue regeneration, and increased vitality. And finally, red light therapy has even been shown to promote hair growth. Now, there are a lot of products on the market. Some are offered at lower prices and may seem like relative bargains, but they don't deliver the type of radiance and frequencies that are required to be effective. While other products do have the required quality, they are vastly overpriced. When doing my research, I found that Neoscience produced the highest quality beds at the most reasonable price. I own the Neolite bed. It's their top-of-the-line product, but they also have less expensive options if cost is an issue. Plus, I've negotiated some generous discounts discounts on all their products exclusively for my audience. Just go to NeolightBed.com and sign up to lock in one of these exclusive offers today. That's NeolightBed.com.
I just checked something over the break, and I'm just commenting on one of my own tweets that it now takes over an hour to process a Bitcoin transaction. Hold on. I almost could have done this during the commercial break. It was a half hour. I tweeted, I don't notice that, and I tweeted out, or not, I didn't tweet it out, excuse me, Elon. I posted on X that it took a half hour, and now it's taken over an hour, 75 minutes, I think, to be exact. And again, the reason it's getting more expensive to use the Bitcoin network is, I guess, the miners have to charge more because they're not getting rewarded as much, so they need to charge more. This is part of the inherent flaw in this whole system. But a couple of points I want to make about this halving. One of the ways they've really promoted it to try to sucker in buyers, and this was another big event like the ETFs that everybody was front running, right? This was something that everybody had to look forward to. Well, now it's not going to happen for another 4 years. So buy the rumor, sell the fact. I mean, I don't see where the good news is coming to help Bitcoin, because the ETFs are here. The halving is passed. Now what do they got, right? You know, there's nothing, right? It's the Bitcoin's going to go down. But one of the ways they've been hyping up the halving is they say, well, there's the supply is cut in half. No, it's not. There's 19 million some odd Bitcoin. The supply is not going down to 9.5 million. No, all that's going down is the rate at which the supply grows. So there's going to be more Bitcoin in the future than there are today. Just that the supply is going to grow more slowly. But we've known that from the beginning, right? It's already hard-coded into the blockchain. This is not a surprise, like all of a sudden there's less supply being created. The markets have known this, you know, from the beginning. So it's not new. But what's relevant to the Bitcoin price is not the supply of new Bitcoin. Because from now, for another 100 years, I'm not sure the exact how long it's going to take, in theory, before the last Bitcoin is mined. I mean, no one's even going to care by then, because no one's going to care about Bitcoin at that point anyway. But we're already at, you know, almost all the way to the 21 million. I mean, we're mostly there. So the supply doesn't matter. What matters is the demand. That's what matters. Do people want it? If they don't want it anymore, then if the supply means nothing, the price is going to crash. It's the supply that's for sale because people don't want to hold it anymore. That's what counts, not what the miners mine. But from the perspective of making this whole thing function, the miners need to get paid to do all this work. And if they're going to get paid less, they got to charge more, which just further undermines the use case of Bitcoin, although the use case has been abandoned because people think it doesn't have to have a use case because it's digital gold. As if gold itself has no use case, which is complete nonsense. You know, I went on Fox Business with Charles Payne, and he had me, you know, talking about Bitcoin with Natalie Brunell, who I've been on Natalie's podcast. I've met her many times in person. She's a nice gal, but you know, she's totally delusional when it comes to Bitcoin. But we go on there and we have this short little debate. And she rattles off a lot of these talking points that she's memorized about Bitcoin. All of it is nonsense. And so I'm listening to this and I'm making my point. But she then puts this up on her YouTube channel, right? The interview. And I went over there and I look at all the comments. And everybody, I mean, it had a lot of views. And everybody is talking about what an idiot I am. How Natalie killed me, she crushed me, I got cremated. You know, I even saw other people putting up these memes of like Natalie kicking my ass, like in various ways. Like I you know, like this is just a perfect example of confirmation bias, because she didn't kick anything. I mean, she didn't beat me. I mean, she made some points that were kind of nonsense and I, you know, pointed it out, but we only had a few minutes. You know, it's a one little segment. But you know, who believe in Bitcoin are so delusional there's such a huge cognitive dissonance that if somebody debates me, I must have lost. I must have been creamed. I must have been crushed, right? And the pro-Bitcoin person, and you know, must have won. And I noticed like a lot of the comments on her website, a lot of the criticisms, like, hey, why is Peter Schiff so blind? Why can't he see what's so obvious, right? Like, I'm just an idiot. And they always conclude that, well, because he sells gold, right? Because he's in the gold business, he can't be objective. And yes, I am in the gold business. I have Schiff Gold. That's part of my business line. The majority of my business is asset management. And if I believed in Bitcoin, I would be buying these Bitcoin ETFs for my managed account customers, right? I make more money from asset management than I do from selling gold and silver. The fact that I'm not buying any of these Bitcoin ETFs is because I don't believe that they're legitimate investments. In fact, I only tell people to buy gold because I believe that they should own it. It's not like I just inherited this gold company and I had to sell gold, even if I didn't believe in it. I started a company because I believed in gold. In fact, the reason I started it was because I was telling people to go out and buy gold, even though I didn't have a gold company. Because that shows you, when I was going out there in public, before I had Schiff Gold, I was telling people to go buy physical gold. I didn't sell it. I was telling them to go find a company and go buy it. Because I wasn't in the gold business. I was in the asset management business. I had no money. I didn't start Schiff Gold until around 2010 or 11. I've been working on Wall Street since 1987. I started my own broker dealer in 1996. We didn't sell gold. So I wasn't bullish on gold because I had gold to sell. I just thought people should buy it. I was a stockbroker. I was buying stocks. I wasn't buying gold. Now, I was buying it. Sometimes I was buying gold stocks, but I was buying all kinds of stocks. The only reason I started Schiff Gold was because a lot of people were getting ripped off. You know, I would find out after the fact that somebody who heard me or read something I wrote went to buy gold and they got sold some scam coins, some phony numismatic coins. They paid a 30, 40% markup. And, you know, that bothered me that people were like taking my advice to buy gold. And then some, you know, gold salesman, you know, bait and switch them into some BS products. So I started my own gold company because I didn't want people who were following my advice to get ripped off. And so the only way I can ensure that that wouldn't happen was to control the business myself and make sure that nobody got ripped off. So that's why I started Schiff Gold, right? So it's not like, you know, I have to sell gold. I want to sell because I believe in it. I believe people should have it. But it's not even where I get the bulk of my income. You know, it's part of my income, but it's a smaller part. Now, I think it's going to become a bigger part now that I think gold is going to keep on rising. And I think more people are going to be buying it. So I do think I'll start to make more money off my gold business than I used to make. In fact, that's one of the reasons I bought it back from gold money. I became more optimistic that the price of gold, you know, we did that transaction. Gold was like 1800. Now it's at 2400. So it was a good move on my part to take the company back, because I do think we're going to see a significant rise in the price. But the point I'm trying to make is that all these Bitcoin guys are criticizing me because, oh, I can't be objective because I sell gold. Nobody is criticizing Natalie. Her entire livelihood is built on Bitcoin. I mean, it's all Bitcoin. I mean, she's made an all or nothing bet. It's not that she invests in Bitcoin. Her entire career, everything she does is built on Bitcoin. So wouldn't she be biased? I mean, she has a bigger reason to be biased, because if she's wrong, she doesn't just lose her money. She loses her livelihood. She loses everything. If I'm wrong and Bitcoin keeps going up, it's not going to hurt me. But look, Bitcoin has gone from, you know, pennies to $60,000. I'm fine. You know, it hasn't hurt me. Yes. Could I have had more money had I bought it? Sure. Yeah, I could have had more, but I got money, right? I mean, I had a good life. And if Bitcoin keeps going up, I don't see how that's going to change my life, right? But if Bitcoin crashes, it's going to destroy the life and career. Now, look, Natalie's young. She's a smart girl or lady. I don't want to, but she could do something else with her life. She's got plenty of time to reinvent herself. But in the meantime, she's biased, just like everybody else. Everybody that goes on television touting Bitcoin is way more invested in Bitcoin than I am in gold. As far as their livelihood. It's not just that they own it. They built their entire lives on it. Their entire reputations have been staked. And in some cases, like Michael Saylor, right, when you borrow all this money, I haven't borrowed any money to buy gold. I'm not levered up into gold. I own some gold, but I didn't go out and borrow billions of dollars to buy it like Michael Saylor did. For MicroStrategy. So nobody wants to question their objectivity. But no. Peter Schiff comes on and doesn't get Bitcoin. Oh, it's only because he sells gold. No, I don't. I get it. I get it more than the people who think they get it. They say, well, why doesn't Peter Schiff just do his homework? Yeah, I did my homework. That's why I know it doesn't work. It's not Bitcoin. It's Bitcon. Just that the people who are being conned don't know it. Anyway, I want to finish up the podcast by talking a little politics. Tomorrow is not only the first day of Passover, but it's the first day of the Donald Trump trial, one of many that's going to go on in New York, where Donald Trump has been charged with 34 felony counts and is facing like 120 years in jail, something like that. 34 counts, 120 years. Oh my God, what did he do? How many people did he kill? Right. I mean, what crime did he commit that he's looking at all these felony charges and all this jail time? Right. Well, the supposed crime was that he paid his lawyer money to pay Stormy Daniels. Right. Stormy got $140,000. Right. Stormy Daniels alleged she had an affair with Donald Trump, or even just not even an affair, really, like a one night stand. It was like a brief, from what I know about it. I mean, it was, you know, they met, they had sex, and I don't know that they ever did it again, even according to Stormy. And apparently, you know, she was hoping to get land a role on Celebrity Apprentice, and it didn't come through. Right. Whatever. So maybe she felt, you know, like a little, you know, jilted there. You know, I slept with you and I didn't get a role, right? Anyway, but she never alleged that there was any kind of rape or anything. But she said there was an affair. Now, Donald Trump was married at the time. In fact, his wife was pregnant with his son, who's now, I think, just high school, Barron. And Trump denies it, right? Trump says it didn't happen. Now, it doesn't even matter. I mean, I guess it does matter because if it did happen, he's lying. But, you know, a lot of guys are going to lie about that. It's not exactly something that, you know, you're excited about admitting to your wife that I cheated on you. So, I mean, sometimes people lie about stuff like that. So maybe he's lying. Maybe he's telling the truth. That's not even what's material here. He paid her to keep quiet, hush money. There's nothing illegal about that, right? As long as it's consensual, right? It's not blackmail. It's like somebody has a story and they say, look, I'm going to tell this story. I'm going to sell my story to the media. But if you don't want it to come out, as long as it's true, and you say, look, you know, I've been offered, you know, money to tell this story. You know, I'm going to take the money unless you want to pay me not to tell the story, right? And as long as it's not a crime, like you're not allowed, like if I know somebody committed a crime, and I say, hey, I'm going to turn you into the police unless you pay me. That's illegal. You can't do that. So she didn't allege there's no crime here in what they did. Consensual sex, right? Assuming it actually happened. And so if Trump pays her money to keep her mouth shut and not go to the papers, that's not a crime. It's totally illegal. So then what's the problem here? Well, they're saying that he falsified records. Well, what do you mean he falsified his records? Well, apparently he didn't write down that he paid her hush money, not to mention a sexual affair. He just paid it as legal fees to his lawyer, who negotiated the whole thing. In fact, the lawyer paid her, not Donald Trump. The lawyer paid her. And then Trump paid the lawyer plus some extra. I mean, quite a bit extra, actually. So I guess there were fees in there. But he was billed. It was, you know, it was structured to be like a legal bill. But again, if you're paying somebody hush money because they're going to talk about an affair that you allegedly had, you're not going to, write it down that way. Who the hell's going to do that? You just, oh, yeah, well, what's this payment for? Well, it's hush money to Stormy Daniels. Well, once you've done that, you might as well not even pay the money. I mean, the whole point of hush money is that it's hush, right? You're keeping it quiet. So anybody who's doing that is not going to, you know, write that on, you know, on the bill. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of times people go to these, you know, on a business trip and they go out of town, they go to these strip clubs and stuff and they use their credit card. It doesn't say strip club. You know, they have some other name or something on there. You know, because people look at the bill, they don't want them to know, oh, gee, this is where you spent your money, right? I mean, so you can't code it. You have to find a way to make it look a little better. So look, he paid his lawyer. It's a legal bill. It's a personal expense. He took personal money and paid his personal lawyer to stop somebody from saying personal stuff about him that would have been embarrassing and may have hurt his wife and family. Now, what they're trying to say is, well, this was during a presidential campaign, so it kind of amounted to a disguised campaign donation. You violated campaign finance laws. In fact, his lawyer ended up pleading guilty to just that violation, campaign finance, because they're saying, hey, this was kind of an in-kind contribution that Trump made to his campaign. Well, first of all, Trump had made all the money. I mean, who cares if he had put in the extra money? But here's the irony of it. Let's say Donald Trump's campaign did pay the hush money. They would have said that was misappropriation of campaign funds. They would have accused him of using his campaign to pay hush money about his personal affair. And he would have said that's an improper use of campaign money. In fact, that's what happened with Gary Hart. I mean, he had somebody came out and accused him, and he actually had some donors. He didn't pay off the hush money. Some donors paid it off. That was much more of a violation than Trump paying it with his own money. But he was used. They said, oh, that's, you know, that was a campaign donation because your donors, right? Instead of giving the money to you, they paid it to this woman to keep her quiet. So they charged him. But the jury didn't even convict him because he basically said, well, I wasn't even related to the campaign. I wasn't trying to cover it up from the voters. I didn't want my wife to know, which is true. What married man wants their wife to know that they had an affair? And, you know, so you have a right. Just because you're running for president doesn't mean you give up your rights. And if somebody wants to say stuff that could endanger your marriage or hurt your wife or hurt your kid, you want to cover it up. That doesn't mean it's campaign. Now, people take advantage of you, right? Donald Trump is running for president. That's why it became a story. If Donald Trump had never run, then Stormy Daniels probably wouldn't have got any money for her story, and he wouldn't have had to pay the hush money. It's kind of like a punishment. He ran for office, and then everybody's looking for ways to take him down. But that doesn't mean that what he did was a crime. But how did they get 34 felonies? Because even if he falsified business records, under New York law, that's a misdemeanor. And it has a 5-year statute of limitations. And that 5 years was up in 2021 before the charges were brought. So how were they able to turn a stale misdemeanor into 34 felonies? This is what's going on. Well, because they said that you falsified your records to cover up another crime, which was this violation of campaign finance laws. Except the federal government charged Trump with violating campaign finance laws because it has nothing to do with the state of New York because it's a federal law that he supposedly violated. So the state of New York is saying because you falsified your records to violate a federal law, that turns it into a felony under New York law. That's BS. And how can they even claim that he violated a federal law when there have been no federal allegations that he violated the law, let alone that he was convicted in a court of violating the federal law. The federal government didn't even see fit to charge him with violating the law. It regarded as a violation. So it's trumped up, and he only did it one time. How do you say that, okay, I falsified the record of paying somebody hush money, right? That's one thing, right? I didn't want people to know that I paid off this woman to expose an affair that may or may not have happened because I didn't want the embarrassment. That's one thing. How do you take one thing and turn it into 34 separate felonies, each one that has, you know, a jail time associated with it? So now you're looking at 120 years. This is preposterous. Also, the whole court is a sham. I mean, the judge should have recused himself. The judge's daughter is a major Democratic fundraiser. She raises a lot of money for Schiff. You know, he's not related to me. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, I've got this relative in Congress because he has the same last name as me. But she raises money for a lot of these big Democrats. Adam Schiff is the guy's name. This is the judge's daughter. And in fact, I've looked at some of the literature that the judge's daughter sends out to fundraise for Adam Schiff and all these other Democrats. And it focuses on this particular trial and these charges. So the judge's own daughter is using the trial that he is presiding over as the judge, using that very trial, the existence of it, to raise money for Democrats. I mean, how could this even be happening, right, in supposedly the country, the United States? How this guy doesn't recuse himself is beyond me. It's clearly political. They're having a trial in New York. I mean, the venue, he's got no chance in Manhattan, right? It's Trump deranging them. All these jurors want to get Trump. They want to convict him. They don't care. In fact, even if he did it, what he did was not a crime. That's the problem. It's like Trump was charged with eating an apple on a Tuesday. Well, what if he ate an apple on a Tuesday? Well, you know, but, you know, it's not a crime. So if he did it, what is he, guilty? What Trump did is not a crime. So even if he did it, how can he be guilty of a crime when his conduct was not criminal? At most, and I wouldn't even agree with this, it was one misdemeanor at most. And there would be no jail time. There would be no trial. There'd be nothing. What if Trump wasn't Trump, right? What if he wasn't running for president? He was just a regular guy who did the same thing. Would there be charges filed here? Of course not. He's not being charged for what he did. He's being charged for who he is. That is illegal. There's something called equal protection under law. Everybody is entitled to the same legal treatment. And so just because you used to be the president and you're a member of an opposing political party, right? If I'm a Democrat and I am a prosecutor, I don't get to charge somebody because they're a former president, because I don't like their politics. Right? It has to be based on what they did, and everybody has to be treated equally. So if Donald Trump is charged for something like this, well, then everybody who does this needs to be charged. That's, again, the same selective prosecution, or this one wasn't criminal, this was civil, for his loans to borrow money to buy real estate, where he's now fighting, and the judge said you have a $100 million fine because you inflated the value of your properties, which is something that every real estate developer does when they apply for a loan, right? Everybody, you know, puts their best foot forward, you know, for, I mean, if you're going to do that, I mean, what about, you know, what about people that are going on online dating sites? You know, you think everybody is honest there when they're talking about, you know, how they look or, you know, other aspects of their personality or wealth? Everybody is honest about themselves? No. I mean, they're trying to make themselves look as appealing as possible. I mean, some of these women, they go on these online sites, they're 10, 20 years old, right? I mean, you know, they get all made up. I mean, you think they list all of their flaws and all of the problems they have, and the same thing with the guys. They probably exaggerate the kind of job they have. I mean, all sorts of things about themselves. You know, they're not going to tell the truth, you know, about what jerks they are and how I'm just looking to get laid. They're not going to put that on their, maybe today, I don't know what it's like now on a Tinder and stuff, but look, it's like everybody is going to try to put their best foot forward, make themselves as appealing as possible. You're a real estate developer. You're trying to get a loan. And so you're going to tell the bank, oh, yeah, I'm a great creditor. Look at all my assets. I got this. I got this. It's worth this. The bank's job is to vet. They know that. Yes, I know the guy's going to come up with these numbers. We're not going to take them on face value. We got a whole loan department. We're going to scrutinize. We do this for a living. We're big boys. You know, we know how this works. And we're going to loan if we're satisfied with the collateral. We're just not going to accept your numbers. We're going to do our homework, which is what they did, which is why the banks, like a Deutsche Bank that loaned Trump money, said, hey, he's a great customer. We'll loan him money again, right? They're perfectly happy. There's no victim. There's no fraud. Same thing here. This is a fake trial. This is a kangaroo court. This is a witch hunt. And everybody should be upset about this. Doesn't matter if you like Trump or not. Democrats should be equally outraged at what's happening to Trump as Republicans. And the Democrats that don't call this out, that exploit this, that act as if he's actually a criminal. Like, oh, this is the first time that a prior president has ever been charged with a crime. Yes, not because he committed a crime, because that's how corrupt our country has become. In the past, our political parties, particularly the Democratic Party, wasn't this corrupt. They weren't so corrupt that they would make up a phony crime and then charge a former president with committing it. The real problem is that he's running for re-election. If Trump wasn't running for re-election, maybe they wouldn't even have done this. Maybe their main goal is to influence the outcome of that election, which is even more ironic because they try to claim that, oh, Trump interfered with the elections. They're interfering. They're interfering with the 2024 elections. That's what all this is about. It's about trying to derail Donald Trump from winning. But, you know, the problem is their plan is backfiring because he's getting more support. You know, I was reading some of these numbers. Where support is really moving up is with African-American voters, particularly males, but also females. He's probably going to get a higher percentage of the African-American vote than any Republican, you know, in modern times. You know, initially, yeah, after Lincoln freed the slaves, the Republicans got a lot of black votes. Ever since FDR, and then in particular, Great Society, LBJ, it's been, you know, a monolithic. The Democrat has taken for granted 95% of the African-American vote, you know, is a gimme. That's not going to happen in 2024. And in fact, the African-Americans are among the most negatively impacted by the economy. And they're going to blame Biden, right? They don't own, as a group, right? They're disproportionately African-Americans don't own stocks, and they don't own their home. They're renting, and they're getting killed. Their rent's going up. Their grocery bills are going up. Their utility bills are going up, and their pets aren't. They're working two or three jobs. Their crime in their neighborhoods are going up. Are they going to vote for four more years? Not a chance. So you're going to see record African-American voting for a Republican, which in a lot of these swing states could be the difference in who wins and who loses. So this could be the first election, really, where the Democrat loses the election because of the African-American vote, not because Trump wins the vote. I don't think Trump's going to, you know, going to get 51%, but he could get 20%, and as opposed to the whatever 4 or 5% that they normally get. And that could be enough to actually tip the outcome of the election. Anyway, that's it for today's podcast. Thanks, everybody, for being here on a Sunday night. Remember, if you like the podcast, give it a thumbs up, leave your comment, and if I like it, I'll comment. Bye for now.